Good morning. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. I'm Scott Tenona, a member here. Before we begin, I'd like to draw your attention to announcements in the order of service right over here. And in addition to these announcements, a couple other things from Annelle Forrester. First, there are voter guides available for you if you haven't voted yet. And reminder that you should be voting on Tuesday. Advanced voting is still available until 12 noon tomorrow. And then one other little bit of information, orders for Koinonia, I think I have that right, products, pecans, bark, candy, date nuts, honey peach cakes are also available from her. So if you'd like any of those, go see her. Raise your hand if you don't know who she is. All right. We have no creed here. No single prophet, no tests of admittance. We search together for what is true, and we work together for what is right, and we allow that we may not agree about either of those. That's the UUA. If you're new here, or you're newish here, and you're interested in what Unitarian Universalism is all about, I invite you to stay after the service and join us in conversation and coffee. You should understand if there's anything that we do worship in common, it's the value of individual thought, the resulting diversity of people's views, and the sharing of those views in ways that let us each grow and do more good in our own lives and in the community. Our services and discussions tend to reflect those values, and I hope today does that. So in this spirit of diversity and valuing independent thought, I invite you all to say hello to your neighbors. Knowing that they don't believe all the things that you believe. Hi. All right. Clara Mayfield is going to be lighting our chalice this morning. And as we light our chalice, a symbol of unity and truth for Unitarians, Universalists, and Unitarian Universalists across the globe, I share words from Ralph Waldo Emerson's essay, The Oversoul. We live in succession, in division, in parts and in particles. Meantime, within man is the soul of the whole, the wise silence, the universal beauty, to which every part and particle is equally related, the eternal one. And this deep power in which we exist, and whose beatitude is accessible to all of us, is not only self-sufficing and perfect in every hour, but the act of seeing and the thing seen, the seer and the spectacle, the subject and the object, are one. We seek the world piece by piece as the sun, the moon, the animal, and the tree. But the whole, of which these are shining parts, is the soul. Today's service is on transcendence, and I'll be saying a little bit more about that topic in a moment as your convener. But for now, I just want to say that you'll notice that the service today largely transcends politics, actually, and makes little reference to the election that's going on and will be happening in a couple days. We do need to recognize that Unitarian Universalism is an active tradition involving people who tend to care very much about civil rights, social justice, economic fairness, equality for women, people of all races, gender, sexual orientation. I urge you not only to vote for your conscience this week, whatever it is, with due attention paid to both facts and your values, but do what you can to get others to do the same. Be politically active. Try to make a difference. But Unitarian Universalism invites us not only to act out, but also to look within And sometimes those looks within are important for helping us to act out. So today, despite, maybe because of, the tensions and craziness in the world outside, I invite you to set aside some time with us to look within and to see how that affects the way we look out. So please join me in singing our opening hymn 398, To See the World. Slavomir will play it through once in its entirety, and then we will sing it twice. There's only one verse, hymn number 398, To See the World. I now invite you to share both the joyful and the sad moments in your lives. We gather in community partly so that we don't have to brave low moments alone, and partly that we get to share in the highlights of each other's lives, and we hope go on inspired and strengthened in our day. If you have a joy or concern you'd like to share, please do so.
My joy is that I have two brothers and a nephew and various people in the northeast of the country, Rhode Island and New York City, in fact, Brooklyn, and everyone came out fine, and that's my joy. And my concern is that there's a really big need in that part of the country right now, and I hope that as few as possible people have to suffer.
Hi, Larry Weaver. This is a joy. A couple of weeks ago, I made some incoherent comments about my feelings of awe and wonder at the natural world. And there was a word that escaped me, but given the topic of the program this morning, I think it's maybe appropriate. The word I was looking for is miracle. Now, I don't mean anything supernatural by that. I just mean, as the song said, in a grain of sand, you've got all the laws of nature. And if you extend that out to look at the community, you got all the love and the passion and commitment and the politics. This world of ours, to me, is a miracle. I'm glad that I can use that word in a congregation that will take the time to understand what I mean and not confuse it with some sort of supernaturalism. It's just that this world is a marvelous, awesome, wonderful, miraculous place.
I have a joy. My son was here for most of the last week, and I was very proud of the man that he has become.
Jim Chanteau. Small concern, I won't be here next Sunday, but the reason is a good one. I will be in Phoenix, actually outside Phoenix and Chandler, with my brother John, spreading the ashes of my mother and my father on the favorite little pond that was outside the home they lived in there for 25 years. Mm. So I'll be missing you all, but it'll be for a good reason.
Michael Oldfather, some of you know, the singers do, that our choir and the First Congregationalist Choir will sing a joint concert here February the 17th in the afternoon. It's a Sunday afternoon. And I've been working with my counterpart, Gretchen Lewis. She gave me a stack of hers from which to choose her songs to choose six, and I gave her a similar stack. And next Sunday, we will sing one of hers here for the Beauty of the Earth, John Rutter's version, beautiful piece of music. And over the next few weeks, several of those new six will be worked into our congregation, into our choir's presentations. Last Sunday, I was there, and I'll be there a few more Sundays between now and then to sing a song, one of our songs, Hallelujah for Our Time, which I think I've conducted about 12 times but had never sung. And it's a great, they're a great group of people, great group of singers, and as I looked out in the audience, I saw that the audience was full of people that all of us know, or many of you would know, and like, and admire, and respect. It's going to be good fun.
I'm Enel Forrester, and also I have a joy. Our son and daughter-in-law were in Alexandria, Virginia, and we're lucky to not have any outage in their electricity, and except for wind and little wind damage, but they're well prepared. I won't be here next Sunday either. We will be celebrating Thanksgiving on Veterans Weekend due to airline hiking of prices, but we'll be visiting the whole family. And the 8th of November, of course, is the anniversary of Burns' death, and that's between after Election Day and next weekend. So also remind everybody, we need to vote. It's very important.
It's interesting to me, the number of people who children or families had good luck, and my sons and daughter-in-law and grandson are still not in their home. They're hoping to get into their home. They lost power last Monday afternoon. I think that's when it hit, Sunday night. They lost power last Monday afternoon, and they have been in motels from going from one motel to another as the motels lost power themselves. So their whole neighborhood now, or their whole block has power, but there was a power line down at their neighbors next door. So it's up now. That power line is up, and so they're hoping they get power today sometime.
For all those joys and concerns expressed and those not, we hold them all in our hearts. Now, if the children want to come on up, I've got a story for us to talk about. Good morning, everyone. That's all right. I'm right here. Yes. See, this way, everybody else can see you, too. I can see you, and they can see you. They can't see me. Back in my head. But that's okay. They don't need to see me. I've got a little story for you. It'll be quick. All right. It's about a girl named Kala. So once, there was a girl named Kala who loved to be outside. She loved to be outside, in the grass, among the birds and the squirrels, and the butterflies and other animals, and it made her feel happy to be that way. She was so happy to be outside that as soon as she came home from school, she'd run right outside. Didn't matter how cold it was, didn't matter how hot it was, she was outside. Sometimes she played with her friends, right? But sometimes she just spent the time on her own, right? Climbing on trees, right? Or playing in the stream and getting all muddy and wet, or just laying in the grass. And it made her happy. And even when the ants started crawling on her arms and tickling her, right, and the bug bites bit her, the bugs bit her and she had bug bites, she was still happy, even though she was itchy. But she was still happy to have been outside. When she was outside, the rest of the world would fade away. Her worries, things she was thinking about at school or about home or anything else would fade away. And she was just like one of the animals, part of nature. It was like it was her home. And the rest of the world almost didn't exist anymore. Now one day, her aunt, I say aunt, some people say aunt. Right? You know what an aunt is? Same as an aunt. All right. Her aunt from the big city came and said to Kala, said, "Why are you spending all that time outside?" I said, "Why aren't you inside doing chores or homework or even just reading or playing with dolls?" And Kala said, "I don't know. I just like it." And her aunt didn't like that answer. Her aunt said, "Well, look, if you can't tell me why you love to be outside, I don't think you've got any business being outside." Kala didn't like that. It made her mad. She doesn't like being told she was wrong. She didn't like that. So she figured she'd have to figure that out. She was good at figuring things out. So she took her microscope, a magnifying glass and a microscope, and she started looking for that thing that made her happy. She took specimens, she took leaves, she took bugs, she looked at them under the microscope, and she'd observe things. She was really good at observing things. She watched where the squirrels buried their nuts, right? And she would notice how two different kinds of plants had different shapes of leaves, right? And she was really patient. She would sit really, really still until butterflies would come by and land near her. Have you ever done that? Kind of wait to see? Have you ever been lucky enough to have a butterfly come right by you and maybe even land on you? It's really hard, isn't it? She would do that. And sometimes she got lucky and she would watch. Once one landed on you, it's so cool when that happens. A dragonfly landed on your nose when you were laying in the water. Oh, that's so cool. Yeah. Yeah. You were releasing monarch butterflies?
One just landed on my shirt, and then it went up to my head, and then it flew away.
Wow, that's it. Landed on your shirt and then your head, and then it flew away. You have an experience, too, like this, Kaya?
My friend, Mari, was a black swallowtail for Halloween.
That is also very exciting. Well, so she did all these things, like the things that you just described, right? And, you know, after all that studying, guess what? She was never able to find that magic ingredient that made her happy outside. She never saw it under the microscope, and she never had it recorded in any of the field notes that she wrote. Right? But it didn't matter. She was still happy. And she had learned some stuff, too, which made her even happier. And you all have just started to tell me some of the things that have happened to you that have made you feel that kind of way, those magical moments. But I wanted to see if you could share some more. Have you had, whatever the kind of moments have you had where just things were so cool, it was so amazing, and you just loved it so much that you weren't even paying attention to anything except for what was happening right at that time?
Once a grasshopper hopped on my head.
Well, there was this time where I was like walking in a tree and then I saw a squirrel right in front of my face.
And what other things besides nature, too, make you feel that kind of way? Let's see, who else has that? What else?
No. Candy.
Candy. What else?
Computer.
Computer time, yeah. What else?
Same thing as that he just said. Computer. When I get to play with my dad on the computer.
What other things make you feel like that? Is there anything else you want to share that makes you just feel you love it so much, it makes you happy?
It's kind of the same thing, but Minecraft.
Drawing. Going to an amusement park.
Oh, amusement park.
Art class.
Reading.
Reading.
I love it.
It's basically the same thing I said, but playing Wizard Raw 1 with my dad. Reading.
Reading, too. I love all those things. We are going to be, why don't we continue to share some of these when we're in our classrooms? As adults, we're going to be sharing some of the things that make us feel that way. And we're going to be talking about why they make us feel that way and what it's like not to sort of really know exactly why, but it just does make us feel good. All right, thanks. Go now in peace. Go now in peace. May the Spirit of love surround you everywhere. Everywhere you may go. Like Emerson, Unitarian Universalists tend not to believe in a non-material God person who's totally outside reality, who's entirely transcendent. So for us, transcendence doesn't usually mean escaping from reality to God's realm. But we don't all reject everything spiritual. Even the most secularly oriented amongst us thinks there's value in being part of a fellowship like ours, even if they're not sure whether it should be called religion in a traditional sense at all. We tend to value the use of reason, but we also honor deep conviction, and we promote the search for meaning in each of our lives. So this service is meant to be an exploration, a chance for us to explore what sort of escape or search for connection with a deeper reality we might each be looking for, and to discuss amongst ourselves what value we find in these things that might be called, in one way or another, transcendent. So to this end, we're going to hear from a few of our members up here today, but I think we're going to have a lot of time afterwards for us each to share our own points of view about this.
Good morning. I have a secret. Sometimes I pray. I know that shouldn't be a big shocker, considering we're all here in our church. But I usually don't share that with anyone. And I have a feeling that a lot of you don't pray, so I feel a little vulnerable sharing that, and also to be sharing what I'm about to share. Perhaps my bigger secret is that I'm not really praying to anyone or to anything in particular. I learned to pray from my grandmother. She was an old Catholic woman with a Jesus painting above her bed, and she taught me to say my bedtime prayers when I spent the night. She taught me to say, "Now I lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. If I should die before I wake, I pray the Lord my soul to take." And I used to say them out of guilt to her and to the Jesus in her painting. But gradually I started feeling disconnected from the idea of God as an all-powerful man up in heaven who was listening to my words. At first, when I started feeling disconnected from that, and doubting his existence, I kept praying just in case there was someone listening. It's kind of like those emails you get where you're supposed to send them on to 10 of your friends. And if you do, then maybe Apple will find out and you'll get a free iPad. And you know it's not true. But what if it were? What if you could get a free iPad and all you have to do is send on your email? So for a while, it was kind of a just-in-case thing for me. But at some point, praying shifted for me. It started opening up a connection to something that was bigger than myself. Even if I didn't understand it or know what it looked like or know what it was called, I got the feeling that putting my wishes out there was somehow making a difference. My belief now is not in a God of our standard definitions, but it's in an energy that flows from us and between us. It's sort of a collective force of our spirituality. Tapping into this energy, for me, seems to strengthen it. Sometimes it feels like intuition, like a knowing of something that I can't see or understand. It's just a feeling. Sometimes the feeling that I get is like a swelling of myself, like my energy is expanding outward and connecting with the energy of others. Sometimes it's just kind of the magic that Scott talked about, you just, it just feels sparkly. It's this connection that I feel. I think connection is really the word that kind of defines it. That's what affects my spirit and gives me what I would consider to be a spiritual experience. I only have a few practices that help me tap into this energy. One of them came recently through reading the Comfortable with Uncertainty book in our adult RE discussion group. It's called Tonglen, and it's a practice of meditating and breathing in whatever you're feeling at the moment, like if you're feeling angry or jealous or something like that, and really feeling it. And it's sort of a cleansing, and you're supposed to really fully feel the yuckiness of it and then breathe it out as freshness. And in doing this, you connect with other people that are feeling the same way you are. Because we all, I mean, I think, I used to think that my feelings were completely individual. And now I sort of see, well, other people feel this way too. And so as a result, I'm feeling more compassion for others. I'm feeling connected to people that I don't even know. And it's new to me, but it's powerful. I also practice yoga, which has opened up my mind-body-spirit connection that I didn't really have before. Being in nature helps, and sometimes I tap into it just by being mindful of the present moment. And, of course, the occasional praying. I don't really have any proof that this energy exists. I can't see it. I can't prove it's there. I don't even know where I came up with this idea. I haven't really shared this with many people other than my kids and my husband, who, it turns out, believes pretty much the same thing that I do. I'm so grateful for our fellowship where I can have this belief and know that maybe some of you think I'm a little crazy, but most of all, I'm going to be accepted for this, and I can say it now and not worry about it. When I read this to my kids this morning, I explained to them how powerful it is for us to have a home where we can believe what I want. This is really the biggest reason that we come here. My belief in this energy that's greater than myself has given me a depth that I don't think I would have if I just experienced life through my senses and my intellect. Perhaps you could say this is my sixth sense, my intuition of this force outside myself that connects us. I can say that tapping into this mystery has given me an openness and a richness that I'm grateful that I have in my life. Thanks.
We'll now receive the morning's offering. Please give as you are able and moved. I wanted to share just one way of thinking about how transcendence might pertain to us. And for me, what I want to share is by way of the Transcendentalist movement in America in the 19th century. This originally New England movement involving people such as Emerson and Thoreau, in which Unitarians claim as part of our tradition, evolved partly as a critique of the idea that God is transcendent and above or outside of physical reality. And incidentally, the Transcendentalists criticized many of the Unitarians of the day for holding views like this. While the Transcendentalists inherited a distrust of Enlightenment reason from the Romantics, and they borrowed mystical ideas from Eastern traditions, they also shared with people like the philosopher David Hume a rational skepticism, for example, about miraculous interventions from a transcendent being. Not only whether such miracles even occur, but more importantly, whether we could ever have evidence of one if they were to occur. The Transcendentalists, roughly, thought that God or something like God was imminent, not to be discovered by special revelation or evidence of miracles. Since they thought that imminent greater being somehow comprised all of existence, they thought we couldn't gain knowledge of that underlying reality through any piecemeal analysis of what we see and experience. They did, however, think we could still make sense of some sort of connection to it with a wider, more roughly intuitive approach. Following Kant, they would say that our concepts, our ideas, our words, empower, but also constrain the way we experience the world. So we never really know reality as it truly is. But our experience is nevertheless connected in a transcendental sense with reality itself, So we can trust our science and our logic, but we must understand them as limited. I say that again because I think that's kind of a neat idea of the transcendentalists. They did think we could trust our science and logic, but they thought what we could trust them for was limited. Unlike Kant, perhaps, they thought we could do more than that. We could look beyond them for more complete answers. And so they turned to other ways to understand the world and ourselves. These sorts of views were, as you probably know, or you might expect, criticized as being overly metaphorical and vague. Edgar Allan Poe famously criticized them, the transcendentalists, as employing mysticism for mysticism's sake. And I mention all this because I think this reflects a bit of the state of Unitarian Universalism today. Many UUs seek, yearn for, or believe in some sort of deeper existence, but we also subject our beliefs to critical analysis. And we tend to care about making things good here now, right? More than we hope for some better life in some transcendental realm. Transcendence, then, in the Unitarian context, might not mean what it would mean in your average Western monotheistic tradition at all. But it still has spiritual meaning for many people. For some, it might mean just something as simple as escaping everyday life. Right? For others, connecting to some deeper reality or unity of nature. For others, simply letting go. For others, not much at all. For others, maybe something entirely something else. So I'd like to invite you now to take a moment for a brief meditation. Pat Embers is going to beat a drum in one of its traditional ancient uses. We won't guide this meditation, but I'd like for you to relax and just sit with a couple questions. The questions I'd like you to sit with are these. What are you seeking? What do you yearn for?
Oh, good morning. My name is Slavomir. I'm a member here. I play the piano for you every couple of weeks. And, music is a very complicated subject. It has, you know, styles, composers, compositions, periods, cultures, social functions, instruments. So However, it remains probably the most immaterial out of the, you know, human activities, because it exists only when it's being played. Otherwise, it doesn't. So maybe it's worth looking at. And we're going to talk about the actual activity of playing music. And in my understanding, performing is basically an act of making connections, all kinds of connections, and there are several of them, and we'll look at each in some detail. The first connection that the musician makes is a connection between parts of his body. For example, by moving hands. It's very much like in a dance. And, you know, many people come to music from very emotional point of view, and they are absolutely unaware that in order to perform music, you need to actually move your body and coordinate body parts. The second connection is the connection that is quite mysterious, is the connection between intellect, emotion, and the body. So we're making intellectual decisions to express emotions while using our body. And this is becoming actually quite mysterious. And that includes also our senses, like the sense of hearing. The other connection that music is a progression of musical thoughts. Let's say music begins happy but becomes sad. How do we, you know, transit from one feeling to the other? So it's an art of making connections between thoughts. It's similar to giving a speech, the linear thinking, or writing also. This is the art of making transitions. On a smaller scale, music is really connecting single notes. And one famous pianist said, well, they asked him, what is the most difficult thing about playing the piano? He said, well, how to play the next note. And that indeed is the right answer. Then, of course, there's the connection between the performer and the physical world, because playing music is actually, in case of the piano, is touching the keys, which seems to be a very simple act. However, there are several ways of touching the keys. The most basic is you can hit the key or you can bounce off from the key. And, of course, there are long notes and short notes, but how short can they be? Are they happily short? Are they dancing? Or are they simply light and like a laughter light? So this is another complicated subject, the connection between the performer and the instrument. Well, there's also the connection between the performer and the concert hall. The performer has to make decisions how loud to play, what is too loud in this room. So there's a connection between the performer and the physical world. And then there's the mysterious connection between the performer and the composer, who happens to be very often deceased a long time ago. And that means understanding the times in which the composer lived, the social structure, the musical fashion, but also you can understand the composer's understanding of human hand, or the composer's understanding of the instrument, how the instrument works. Some composers, even though very democratic in spirit, like Beethoven, they seem very dictatorial on the page. They tell you exactly how everything is supposed to be played. And then, of course, the most mysterious is the connection between the performer and the audience, something that cannot be measured. And then, so the person is playing the music of someone who is, in most cases, deceased. For people who come to see the performer playing that person's music, so it's quite mysterious. It cannot be measured again. There's a different sense of time for the performer and for the audience. I'd say a boring concert can last forever. And, of course, when the performer is in trouble on stage, that 10 seconds can last really a very long time, that too. I would say there are some other mysterious aspects of music, and I would call them the musical instinct, the musical talent, or the musical mind. And I think mysterious because they're not needed for survival in the physical world. They're not needed, like, for example, to gather food or to defend ourselves against predators. So why does this exist at all? That's a very good question. I think it might exist because exactly it helps us establishing these connections between mind, thinking, feeling, doing. That's the purpose, so we can exist more fully. And of course, there's the question of musical perception. Perception that is different in case of each individual. Each one of you heard a different version of the Brahms intermezzo this morning. But that differs not only between individuals, but also between cultures. So this is something that, well, musical perception is a mystery too. And I wanted to end with a quote by Samuel Johnson. Of all the noises, music is the least disagreeable.
Good morning. I'm Anna. I teach yoga. The name of my business is Yoga Connection. I've been hearing the word connection a lot this morning, and I've been hearing beautiful things and wondering how can I follow up these beautiful words of Kim's and Slavomir, because I just have written down a very cold scientific thing here about the science of yoga. Shanti, peace to you. Yoga is a word which names the state of mind which the yogi is striving toward. Personal integration, connection, mind, body, etc. It's kind of like the instrument and the musician. This state of mind is complete freedom from the normal neurosis which most humans live with. So we have to have a good imagination. Yogis religiously use various practices in an attempt to attain this purity and freedom of the mind, because we believe that once attained, it can free us from our own mental suffering and in turn be of benefit to those around us. So basically I'm talking about a practice here, not really a belief. This brief summary needs a more detailed explanation. So, though not a religion, yoga arose from the religious tradition known as Vedanta. One idea behind the practice of yoga is that you have attained this precious human life, and here is a way to make the most of it, because you don't really have much time, you see. Although body postures and exercises are famously a part of yoga, it is little known that yoga actually emphasizes the subtle parts of our being. It is the mind, not the body, which is the major focus of yoga. Those familiar with yoga are aware there is no divide between mind and body, and I'm sure the other speakers this morning are fully aware of this, and I'm sure many of you probably already are. so I won't go any further with that. But let's look at the mind. What is the mind? It has been called a non-local field of energy and information. The only way we know that the mind exists is through our observation of its activities. In the Yoga Sutra, they're listed 5, true perception, wrong perception, imagination, deep sleep, and memory. By those 5, we know the mind exists. These are the activities of the mind. Breath and energy are also emphasized in our practice, which are also invisible. We generally tend to ignore these subtle components of our being. Instead, our attention is distracted by things we can see, touch, taste, hear, etc. To practice yoga is to bring the awareness inward and observe the breath, the energy, the state of mind. This practice of self-observation helps us refine our ability to perceive and trains our attention. It's a lot like praying. As we learn to focus, we begin to know ourselves more intimately, and we notice things we may not have noticed about ourselves. We cannot change that which we are not aware of, I tried to write that correctly. So a great yogi, T.K.V. Desikachar, said, "The ultimate goal of yoga is to perceive things correctly so that we never act in a way that we will later regret." On the path to this ultimate goal, there are many small triumphs and some setbacks as well. The Yoga Sutra tells us that the yogi who is able to have faith will attain her goals more easily. Patanjali acknowledges that some people have a greater propensity for faith, and depending on the person or the circumstances, one's faith may grow or diminish. One aspect of faith is the ability to accept what is and to understand that we are not in control of everything. This is not a small step. To go beyond our present limitations requires that we first accept them. So once we thus accept our limitations, we can calmly begin to explore our situation and gradually to find that more may be possible with practice or with prayer. And so I'd just like to end by saying that when we release our need to control and accept our limits, we open to a space in our mind for joyful exploration of our lives When we release our need to control and accept our limits, we allow space for the mind to joyfully explore our lives and use them better to better ourselves and others. I give gratitude to all my teachers. Namaste.
Thank you. As I said, I want to leave time for us all to share because none of us owns anything in this area. So I invite you all to share what you want out of UUFM, particular, out of your life. Whether this is the first time you've been here, you can't count how many times you've been here. We have a community here deemed religious, whatever that means to you. To what degree and how are you looking for something that transcends what we could get out of ordinary other ways of interacting in communities, book groups, lectures, political action? Assuming there's something about UUFM that goes beyond the parts, what is it? How do you find it? Just in general, what does transcendence mean to you? What are you looking for? Please share.
My name is Mark Long, and well, I guess I'd just like to maybe share a little bit about myself, because, well, I think transcendentalism has a lot to do with the individual and how they relate to everything around them. And so I read Ralph Waldo Emerson, and one of his books was Self-Reliance, and one of the things he said was nonconformance is very important, not just falling in with the crowd is very important. And so when we're talking about openness, experience, tradition, and belief, all these things are very individual, and you know, when we do fall in with the other crowd, you know, we lose personal meaning. And so that's my thoughts.
Thank
Okay. Jim Shanto. Actually, I had two thoughts, one relatively shallow, and the other hope a little deeper. The first, I was looking around this morning and came to an awful realization. I think I'm the longest continuing member now of this fellowship who's here today. I started in 1972. Oh, you're here. I was looking to see if Ann was here because I knew she... 70, 2 years. Well, second. And now?
71.
71. Third. Yeah, anyone else? Well, my point was we've transcended all the changes that have occurred over the years. That meant we went back to Bluemont Avenue, the house there, met in the upstairs, the downstairs, and every other part of that now old rickety building. And here we are in this glorious place. I mean, this is a magnificent facility, and I'm not sure that we really appreciate it as much as we should. I'm looking out of marvelous views both ways. I mean, this is just an incredibly nice place to be. My other thought, following Slavomir's comment about music, I can't possibly approach the talents that he has and my rather small efforts as an amateur musician. But one of my experiences back when I was in high school that really taught me, I guess what I'm trying to do is the transcendence of music, was the first time as a jazz musician I saw something on the page and the music stopped and it said ad lib. That means just play. Whatever comes to you, you play. There is nothing there. Sometimes there's chords. Other times it's just bars. It's just bars go past. And you're supposed to play. And when I first saw that, I was scared out of my mind. I still am to some extent when I see that, but now I've learned how to handle that. And I think you need to get yourself into that transcendent point in order to accomplish that, because what you're producing is for that point in time only. You are the composer, the performer, you're also the audience for what you're producing, and it will never happen again. That's as transcendent an experience in music as I know of.
Ann Martin, well, I guess this hurricane has kind of made me think about, I think the most transcendent thing for me is when we kind of go against our nature, which I guess we're animals, and we, you know, get the nut away from the other squirrel kind of thing. But to see human beings, to see human beings reach out and help people that are desperate, and if, you know, and, you know, in whatever case, whether it's an auto accident where you stop and help people, that's the most, and, you know, I think the Unitarian Universalist thing of standing on the side of love, I think that's maybe the kind of love they're talking about. So, anyway.
Hi out there, Diane. I'm Katie Kingry Page, and I just wanted to share kind of in response to Scott's question about what do you seek in the Unitarian Fellowship. Around the year 2000, I was reading the writings of Mircea Eliade, who some of you may be familiar with. He's a comparative religion scholar. He has a great book called The Sacred and the Profane. And it was reading that book that made me realize I might be a religious person, because up until then, I really rejected the idea that I was seeking anything sacred. I've always identified as a free thinker and certainly not a theist. But in reading how he defined the sacred, what I recognized was that I was always seeking that, and he defines it as something set apart from the everyday and the ordinary. So whether it be sacred place, sacred time. Shortly after I read that book, I had my first child, and in that birth experience, I realized sacred time. I knew it was real, what he was talking about, this time that's set apart. So I think that's why I come to UU, because I'm interested in those things that some might call sacred, or those of us who are non-believers might just say it's set apart.
I'm Harriet Yonke, and we were up at Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota this week. My husband had a couple of checkups, and they believe in the power of art to heal. It's like going to an art museum, and we've been up there before. He's had a couple surgeries, and I've had a lot of time to walk around the halls, and every hall has something. You get out of an elevator, there's needlework and artwork from every country you can think of that has been given to them. They've got 13 Chihuly things hanging in one lobby, and just things that I love to go and see again. We've been up there so many times, but it just the power of art to take your mind off your troubles and just enjoy it. And it just, it helps the patients, it helps the spouses.
I'm still Michael Oldfather. At the Musicale last time, I sang a silly song, a Homer and Jethro song, a Frozen Lager lover. And this has to do with connection to the audience. That afternoon, a grandchild of a neighbor came over and said, "I loved your song. It was hilarious." And so even an amateur musician can connect with an audience now and again.
Well, Diane Barker, and my training, should I call it training, is in poetry. And so I love the transcendentalists, I love the romantic poets, I love William Blake, Rumi, all of that. And my understanding of transcendence now, though, is very much physical. We, being here together, will never be in this moment again. The earth will never be in the state that it's in. And I want to appeal to everyone to recognize that the earth is in, the earth needs help. And it will take all of us to get through getting off our addiction to oil. I live out on a hill where the bluebirds greet me every day. There was a marsh hawk. I have a whole deeper understanding of the birds because I was watching cedar waxwings are so beautiful. And the cedar waxwings were at the little watering, the bird bath. And I don't know, I was just transported by their very physical presence. And so this film, The Age of Stupid, was directed by an incredibly brilliant woman in the UK, Franny Armstrong. And after she made this film, which is just a very honest and scientifically based depiction of what climate change is doing to the planet and how we don't know how fast it's going to come upon us. And I think the recent storm in New York is a real wake-up call. But anyway, after she made this film, she had to do something. So she started 1010. This film came out in 2009. She made an appeal to the UK and said, "Please come in and pledge to reduce your carbon footprint 10% by the next year, by 2010. It's now 2012. I mean, many people have known that we were approaching some kind of environmental collapse if we didn't wake up. And so probably a lot of you know of a lot of other films. You know, I talked about Our Daily Bread is a great film, a documentary on how our food is actually produced. This is a great film. It's at the Manhattan Public Library. Both of them are. And if any of you have other films that are kind of like, what, your favorite disaster film? Please share them with the fellowship. Thank you.
Thanks, Diane. That's a wonderful thing. And really important when it comes to spirituality, does not only have to do with the unseen. It does not have only to do with the mysterious, although climate change is mysterious because we don't really know. But it has to do with the reality of the physical world.
It's just as spiritual as anything. So that's a real important, and in my talk I did say something about being no separation between the physical and the mental, between the mind and the body. There really is no separation. And we need to understand that it's going to hurt us in many more ways than just the weather changing. And we need to be responsible for our body and the body of the earth, which supports it.
I need to stand up, sorry. Dave Lambert. As many of you know, I grew up in the Sacramento Valley. I went to school at Davis. And whenever I could, I spent time up in the Sierras because I love being in the Sierras. And probably 40 years ago, I was up there camping with some friends. And I remember Sunday morning, very, very early. I have no idea why we were on top of this ridge that early on a Sunday morning, but it was just spectacular. There were four or five of us up there surrounded by the range of light, as John Muir called it, just a spectacular morning, transcending our human existence. While we were sitting there, this other fellow and girlfriend, wife, I forget what it was, said, well, I really hate to do this, but I need to leave now. And we said, well, why? This is, you know, here we are, this beautiful setting. He says, well, I need to go back to Davis to go to church. And as he walked down the trail, I must admit I was somewhat judgmental. But since then, I guess I've come to realize that we all transcend our reality in different ways.
Thank you. One more comment.
I'm Ann Cowan, and I can relate with everything that's been said here. The art, the music, the nature, and whatever. But there is something that I can get so lost in that I'm in another world, and I don't think it's a worship, but anyway, it's numbers. So when I want to really get philosophical about something, I read a math book, and I read proofs, and I love it, and I don't always understand them, but the concept of numbers and the relationship to each other that goes on and on forever is just my thing I'm in most awe of.
Beautiful. Thank you, everybody, for commenting. Please join me now.
We have one more.
Oh, is there one more? Sorry, go ahead.
Gene Seavers. I guess one person's transcendence could be another person's agony, huh? I'm a member of the Commune Artists Group, and I appreciated Harriet's comments. One of our activities that we do is a monthly rotation through the Wright's Oncology Radiology office here in town of small works, individuals rotating their artwork, pottery, prints, photos, oils or watercolors through that office. And we get really positive appreciation and positive comments from that. I guess if I were to think of transcendence, it would be mostly related to the arts, and probably most the most dramatic would be dance. And since I have a great degree or a lack of proprioception, I translate that to my pottery. Because as I'm in the rhythm of making the pottery and the different steps and movements, I do sort of lose a sense of time or the real world when I'm just occasionally in that spot where I'm sort of outside myself, but yet relating to something that's fairly special.
Thank you. Please join me now in singing hymn number, or closing hymn 369. This is the truth that passes understanding. Again, Slavomir will play it once through, and then we'll sing it twice. parting, I'd like to offer you these words adapted from several translations, mostly by Kai Nelson, of Chapter 10 of the Tao Te Ching. Can you bring the whole of you and be at one? Can you gather your energy and make it as soft as a baby's? Can you clean the dust from your eyes and see things clearly? Can you lead without cleverness? As life comes and goes from the world, can you be strong like a woman? Understanding clearly, can you be without knowing?